Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
A new year and a whole new political landscape. That means a whole new business landscape, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, January 2nd. Thanks for joining us and Happy New Year. Most of the incoming Trump administration's key economic nominations have now been announced. The secretaries of Treasury, Commerce, Labor, and of course, a special slot for billionaire activist investor Carl Icahn. He will be in charge of regulatory reform, although it sounds like much of that might end up being deregulation. Many Obama administration policies will be on the chopping block, and so might entire federal agencies. That could all take time to implement, which could affect a lot of business decisions in the coming year. From our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman takes a look.
The National Federation of Independent Business surveyed its members after the November election and found a surge in small business confidence, with expected sales and hiring both up by double digits from the month before. NFIB chief economist William Dunkelberg.
They think that a different management philosophy in Washington will be very helpful in terms of legislation or suspended regulations.
He says aside from getting rid of Obamacare, business owners will be closely watching Trump's new labor secretary, fast food executive Andy Puzder, to see how much of the Obama administration's labor policy can be reversed and how fast.
If you go the first year and you don't get anything done, obviously this enthusiasm is going to dissipate pretty quickly.
Now, Trump will be able to reverse some Obama administration executive orders and policy guidelines with the stroke of a pen, on wages and sick pay for federal contractors, on when parent companies are responsible for labor violations by their franchises, on who's an employee and who's an independent contractor. But sweeping new overtime rules that would make millions of workers eligible for time and a half, reversing that is a bigger challenge, says University of Richmond law professor Carl Tobias.
To rescind a rule of that sort, you basically would have to reverse it, open it up for public comment again, and it would take some time. Also, the litigation is ongoing.
Ray Keating at the Conservative Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council wants to see more than a reversal of what's been done over the past 8 years.
Regulatory reform in general, but also a moratorium on new agency regulations.
Whether all this drives job creation and business investment higher in the coming year will depend on how rapidly and how widely regulatory reform takes effect. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
When the official numbers come in, online sales for the 2016 season are expected to total about $91.6 billion. That is up 11% over last year, according to Adobe. And that also means an increase in work for shipping companies. UPS and FedEx both expected big increases in the number of packages shipped between Thanksgiving and New Year's. Now, in the past, the shipping giants have not kept up with increased package traffic, and that has led to some sad holiday shoppers. Marketplace's Mariel Segura takes a look at how things went this year.
In two words, not bad. In December, UPS's on-time delivery rate was 97.2%, 1% lower than last year, according to audit company Shipware. FedEx was at 96.5%, compared to 97.1% last year. Shipware president Trevor Outman says those on-time numbers are actually pretty good, considering the huge increase in packages.
The trend and the volume compared to last year is significant. You know, the growing trend of people shopping from their phones and shopping online, people are getting more comfortable buying various and new items online, including tires.
The shipping companies have another issue to deal with: last-minute promises by online retailers. John Haber is CEO of Spend Management Experts.
They're pushing the envelope in order to get the last sales, and that creates a challenging environment for UPS, for FedEx.
Shipware's Outman says UPS and FedEx performed as well as they did this year because they changed their operations after huge shipping failures in 2013.
Since then, they've taken many steps, notably in investment in technology and more infrastructure, more hubs, to prevent that from happening again.
Northwestern University professor Alexander Chernev says customers shouldn't expect UPS or FedEx to get much more efficient than they are now.
And around holidays, you always have much greater demand. It's very likely you're always going to have some late deliveries. That's just inevitable.
But he acknowledges that's little consolation if it's your package that's late. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, markets are closed for the New Year's holiday, but we'll have some other details for you when we do the numbers. One of the biggest consumer technology trade shows in the world takes place in Las Vegas later this week. I will be there for CES, getting a look at the trends of the next year in technology, and also at the gadgets and doodads that might be on next year's holiday shopping lists. Or maybe not. According to Farhad Manju, a tech columnist at the New York Times, the good old gadget is on its way out and software is where it's at. He's here to talk with us about his prediction for a gadget apocalypse. Farhad, welcome to the program.
Hey, good to be here.
Okay, so I get it that we're seeing a decline in some hardware, but winter is coming, the gadget apocalypse? You have no optimism for this entire category?
I mean, it's been declining for a while. It's just been the case that I've just haven't seen any hardware products that have really excited me. The one, I can think of a couple of exceptions, but they're exceptions for a reason. The Amazon Echo is something I use a lot, but it's barely a gadget. It's just sort of a cylinder you put in your kitchen and almost all of its intelligence is in the cloud and software. The new gadgets sort of exist mainly as like accessories to the smartphone.
So what do you mean when you say gadget? It seemed like from your column you really meant like a thing that you carry around or maybe a wearable. Like you don't feel like all the new virtual reality rigs or the smart thermostats. Like could it be possible that we're just redefining gadgets towards something like the Echo?
Right. I think that's a good point. And I think it's possible. I think, though, that gadgets will sort of never have this central place in our lives the way, you know, the way the Walkman did or the Game Boy or, you know, like the iPod. You know, the iPod was a gadget. I really wouldn't call a smart thermostat a gadget. It just feels like it's a better thermostat than the old days. So we are kind of redefining what a gadget means. And I think the redefinition is basically like everything is now connected and, you know, and the smartphone is the one that controls everything.
Yeah, I used to joke that every single year for the last 15 years, the next big thing was basically the internet or right. some version of it. But we, you know, it did appear for a time that we were on the verge of sort of a hardware renaissance. What is it, just the smartphone, or do you think that there's hope for hardware in the future?
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like we were on the verge of a hardware renaissance because of things like Kickstarter. And it also seemed that there were all these new technologies on the horizon that appeared to be much closer than they were. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of awesome stuff on the horizon, but, you know, they're not close to where you and I would carry them around as our favorite gadgets.
So maybe it's not so much that winter is coming. It's just that the gadgets are hibernating. Oh, I took it too far.
That's awesome. Yeah, they're hibernating. Yeah.
That's Farhad Manju, tech columnist for the New York Times. Thanks so much, Farhad.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Now, come to think of it, CES did used to be short for the Consumer Electronics Show, but the trade show has rebranded itself as just CES, so it's not so, you know, gadgety. The U.S. is in the midst of a conversation about parental leave and affordable, high-quality health care. So here's a story from Denmark that's probably going to make you a little jealous, at least at first. I'm talking about that country's so-called Nordic model, which includes state-subsidized child care for kids between ages 1 and 5. It has helped a lot of mothers get back to work without breaking the family budget, but it doesn't come cheap. And Denmark, like many other countries in Europe, is feeling the economic strain. The BBC's Marie Keyworth reports.
Stina Christensen lives in Værløse, a village a few miles outside Copenhagen. She's the mother of 3 children, all under the age of 4. And the morning routine means getting them all ready to be dropped off at childcare by 8:30 a.m. It's because Stina has recently started back at work, doing a job where she's in the office 4 days a week.
I really enjoyed my time with the kids, but after that I really needed to come out again and be around adults and not just do baby stuff.
In many other countries, the price of sending three children to daycare would be toe-curlingly expensive, but it's not in Stina's case.
For all three kids, we pay about 5,200 kroner each month. That's about $700. It's definitely affordable.
This kind of affordable childcare is made possible because the Danish state subsidizes it in a big way. Local authorities are legally required to pay around three quarters of childcare costs while parents make up the rest. And the reason the state can afford to do this is because Denmark has one of the highest tax rates in the world. The average Dane pays a total amount of 45% in income taxes, and for higher earners, it's 50%. And it's no accident that this system helps Stina get back to work. That's why it exists in the first place. Stig Brostrom is professor in early childhood education at Aarhus University.
Because of the call for women at the labour market, we succeeded in increasing the number of children in preschool.
Stina drops her three kids off at Seoul Mountain Kindergarten and heads to work, leaving them in the capable hands of the team there. The result now is a country where a child growing up in Denmark is unusual if they don't go to childcare. In fact, the figure is 98% of preschool children are part of the childcare system, but it's not without its problems. Denmark, like many countries across Europe, has experienced its share of government belt tightening since the 2008 financial crisis.
My name is Dorte Bo Danbjerg, and I'm the president of the National Parents Organization in Denmark. I've had kids in kindergarten since 2005, and every year there have been discussions about cuts in the kindergartens when the municipalities negotiate their budgets.
The childhood education expert Stig Brostrom says,
without dramatization, I will say if we continue in that track the next 10 years, we have lost our early childhood educational success. So if we really want to have a generation of young people who have social competences, who have skills for doing innovation, then of course you have to pay.
Denmark's much coveted system now hangs in the balance.
That report was brought to us by the BBC's Marie Keyworth in Denmark. Coming up,
we are tied into each other and plugged in ways we've never been before as the human race.
An alien movie that is about so much more than just aliens. But first, let's do the numbers. The major markets are closed today for the New Year holiday, so here are a few alternative numbers. One, that's the average pound of weight people gain over the holidays. Not the 5 to 10 pounds most people imagine. The problem is that most of us never lose that pound. So over a decade, you're packing 10 pounds on the scale and on and on. $342 million, that's a sale of paper, appointment books, and planners. An increase of 10% from 2014-2015. I bought one too, and decorative and other calendars are up too. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. We are nearing the end of the college football season, which means, of course, bowl games. There are four of them today alone. The games are a team's reward for a successful season, and of course, they help decide the national championship teams. But this year, there were a couple of notable absences over the weekend. Stanford running back Christian McCaffrey and LSU's Leonard Fournette decided to sit out of their team's bowl games. They didn't want to risk injuries that could damage their NFL draft positions and their future contract amounts. See, teams and conferences get paid for appearing in bowl games, but players do not. So we wondered whether these sit-outs could reignite the debate over compensation for college athletes. Marketplace's Andy Euler looked into it.
McCaffrey and Fournette are marquee names, but the games still happened, and Americans still tuned in. That's what TV networks and advertisers care about. Patrick Ruby is a fellow at the University of Texas and contributing editor at Vice Sports. He says a couple of players sitting out is one thing, but
where this could get dicey would be if an entire team or a large group of players were to decide to sit out or boycott.
Players want to be paid for playing on TV and being featured in video games. A boycott would likely put pressure on the NCAA to move quickly. B. David Ridpath teaches sports business at Ohio University. He says players don't realize the power they wield.
We may see something like that, whether it's a complete general strike or maybe small things where Alabama or North Carolina basketball, whatever it may be, decides to do something like that to say, look, this is not right. Believe me, things will change.
He says we're still probably years away from that happening, and there are a number of cases fighting the NCAA pay rules still in the courts. Michael McCann is a professor at the University of New Hampshire School of Law.
If it's going to radically change its rules, it probably won't happen because of a lawsuit. It probably won't happen because a player or two sit out a game. It will likely happen because conferences decide they want to be more autonomous.
The Big Ten, SEC, and even some individual schools now have TV networks. He says if they strike a different deal with athletes, independent of the NCAA, they might include compensation. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Sam Maggs is the author of a book called Wonder Women, 25 Innovators, Inventors, and Trailblazers Who Changed History. The book, as you might have guessed from the title, details the lives of women who were pioneers in their field. And here on Marketplace, we've been doing an occasional series highlighting some of the people featured in that book. So today, the story of prolific inventor Margaret Knight.
If you've ever gone to a fast food joint and picked up a burger in a paper bag, you have Margaret Knight to thank for that. Margaret Knight grew up in the late 1800s visiting her siblings in textile factories where she witnessed a lot of horrible things go down, like workers getting injured by falling spindles. So when she started to see these things going wrong in the factories, she invented an auto stopper at just 12 years old that she was able to put into factories all across the East Coast of the United States that made them way safer for workers. As she got older, she got a job in a paper bag factory where she would work on a machine that put together envelope-style paper bags. Flat-bottomed paper bags are much more useful, but there was no machine that could do the work of creating a flat-bottomed paper bag at a time. Women would have to sit and by hand fold and glue flat-bottomed paper bags together. Margaret found this unconscionable. No man had been able to invent a machine that could do this, so she was just like, whatever. I'm going to invent this machine. Years of work later, she invented a machine that could do the work of 30 people folding and making flat-bottom paper bags, decided to patent her invention, and it was stolen by a man. And his legal defense was basically, well, she's a woman, so she could never have thought of this. But after many weeks on trial, during which she showed all of her original notes, the judge awarded the patent to her. And from there, she was very successful. She invented over 80 different machines over the course of her life. And when she died, lots of newspapers heralded her as the woman Edison, although I kind of think that Edison was probably the dude Margaret, but that's beside the point.
That was author Sam Maggs. Her book is Wonder Women, 25 Innovators, Inventors, and Trailblazers Who Changed History. Now, Sam Maggs also appears in a special edition of Marketplace that we recently released. It's an episode of our show that wonders what Marketplace would sound like if superheroes were real and what that would mean for our economy. So we have the economics of having a secret identity, the startup opportunities for superhero suit makers, and a little angst from Silicon Valley. I'm in that part. You can find this special superhero edition of Marketplace at our website. That is marketplace.org. Okay, yeah, there was a new Star Wars movie in 2016, and that is getting all the end-of-year headlines. But a very different alien movie was a hit last year, too. The film Arrival stars Amy Adams as linguistics professor Louise Banks. She is tasked with figuring out how to talk with extraterrestrials after they arrive on Earth.
Louise. I am Louise.
What is that? Is that a new symbol? I can't tell.
Dr. Banks?
She's taking off her helmet. Okay, now this was a smart sci-fi mystery, and it plays with some heady science concepts, but it also fits in a touching story of a mother and her daughter and humanity's response to the aliens and each other. It started out as a novella, and Eric Heiserer adapted the story for the screen. Eric, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm wonderful, and I have to say I read that when you first read the novella on which this movie is based, that you said you felt gutted and uplifted at the same time. And I wanted you to know that is exactly how I felt coming out of this movie.
Good. Then I preserved that. That's good. That
yes,
was like mission
exactly.
One for me.
What was it about you that said, this has got to be a movie?
Honestly, it was the way it made me feel. I thought, if I can capture this feeling and make a cinematic version of the story, then I can point more people toward the author, Ted Chiang, who I've been obsessed with for a long while. Mm-hmm. And I can tell a story that I haven't seen very often in film.
You can tell there are many difficult science concepts in this movie. The primary one is this idea of linguistic relativity.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, everyone. But can you give us a quick explainer? Are you good enough to like synthesize it and tell us what that means?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you that it is a somewhat controversial idea in the linguistics community. And Ted Chiang takes it into a sort of a science fiction territory where he goes. But it's about the fact that when you immerse yourself in a foreign language, you really kind of rewrite your brain and you can dream or even sort of it can change your view of the world. Hmm. And I had a personal experience with this when I was a child growing up. My father was a classics professor at OU for like 30 years. And he was constantly teaching himself new languages. In fact, he would make his own little flashcards. And to learn a new language, he would brush up on another one. So he'd have like Aramaic on one side of the card and German for the translation on the other.
Wow.
Yeah. And he was also just the absolute stereotypical absent-minded professor in that, you know, I never know what era he was in when I would go up to him. Like, like, are you in ancient Greece right now, Dad? Because I need you right here for dinner.
I'm actually seeing how this all drew you to this novella, by the way. This is we're getting into therapy territory here.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Especially because like he had this replica of the Rosetta Stone in his home office. And the idea of like three different languages and how they're translated always fascinated me. But I remember asking him a question at one point in time, and I interrupted a language lesson he was teaching himself. And he looked at me and blinked, and it took him a good 10 seconds to switch back to English. And that made me wonder, how is he thinking? What language is he natively thinking in now? And I didn't realize until I ran into this story years and years later that it's a real thing. So I latched onto it.
This is a film I understand was very difficult to get made. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that journey and why you got so many no's at first.
Well, I think I got a lot of no's at first because it's an outlier. You know, there is an increasing need for studios to produce only franchise material. You know, I can tell you if someone came up to any studio now with just a screenplay or a story idea for Interstellar or Gravity or The Martian, it wouldn't go anywhere. In order to make these kind of films, you need prestige directors and stars that can signal to the studio, this isn't a lost leader. This will actually go somewhere, even if it's not a franchise piece. And, you know, particularly if it doesn't have a male lead, they get worried.
And yet Amy Adams, and I felt watching it, Amy Adams has said that this film is very much about a mother telling the story of her daughter. Without that, do you think the movie would have anywhere near as much weight?
No, absolutely not. I mean, that's really what drew me to it. I mean, it's the story, in my opinion, and certainly hopefully the film adaptation, is a love letter to mothers. It's like a giant thank you note.
And yet, perfectly crafted to just stab us in the heart. Just right in the heart.
Yeah.
I read that you had identified Amy Adams from the get-go.
Yes.
What is it about her?
I think it's that I can see what she's thinking when she's acting. Like, I can tell that something's going on in her brain just through her eyes. And I find that as an unusual trait in actors.
So in addition to being a movie about having to learn to communicate with aliens, it is clearly also a movie about humans having to figure out how to communicate with each other. Did you find that you learned anything about that part of it, or what did you learn about the way people interact?
I learned that there is a, you know, an often invisible bias that's always present when it comes to communication. And more and more people seem to try and customize the channels for communication in a way that it sort of reinforces that bias. We are tied into each other and plugged in ways we've never been before as the human race. And we are really terrible at communicating. So we got to get better.
Eric Heiser is the screenwriter for the movie Arrival. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And one final note before we go. I feel like most parents understand that the difference between a good gift experience and a bad gift experience is whether you have batteries for the toy your kid just opened. And sometimes you don't. So hats off to Duracell, which created a program and really an ad campaign around Duracell Express. On Christmas Eve, between noon and midnight, you could go online and request batteries. And a driver from the delivery service Postmates would bring them to you for free. The service only operated in 3 cities, according to Adweek, but Duracell said it delivered over 1 ton of batteries. So may I suggest that they go ahead and make that a real thing next year and not just an ad campaign? It doesn't even have to be free. I mean, I think they could probably charge double. Markets were closed today in observance of the New Year's holiday. They will reopen tomorrow. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I am Molly Wood. Lizzie O'Leary will be back tomorrow and for the rest of the week. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.